18. Cruising, boozing, scoring. Fired up, I dusted off a story I had written for English class my junior year, based on a true series of events. I was a reporter for my high school newspaper, and one of my fellow reporters was a bright, socially awkward guy who didn't run with the cool kids. A popular girl in our class led him on, making him think that she was into him. She lured my friend into kissing her in public, only for a bunch of the girl's friends to run out from a hiding place and laugh, humiliating him. It turned out that the girl was rushing a sorority, and kissing a dorky guy was her initiation rite. I turned this sad tale of high school dynamics at their cruelest into a screenplay entitled The Initiation. It was the first sound film I ever made, in 16mm with the actors actually speaking dialogue. We shot it shortly before I started at USC, with the kissing scene taking place in Buena Vista Park, one of my childhood haunts. My friend and sometime writing partner, Craig Hundley, who is now better known as the LA musician and composer Craig Huxley, was rail thin and gawky, so I cast him as the lead, an introverted piano savant. Susan Richardson, a young actress who had a small part in American Graffiti, played the popular girl who seduced him. Charlie Martin Smith made a walk-on appearance as one of the girl's laughing friends. My Burroughs friend, Doug DeGrazio, was my cameraman, and we used some serious equipment. I rented an Eclair 16mm camera, and Haskell Wexler was kind enough to lend me a small dolly that allowed us to maneuver the camera more smoothly. We filmed over 3 long days, and Doug and I edited the film at the post-production shop where he worked part-time, sweeping up and running errands. It was located on a seedy stretch of Western Avenue in Hollywood, in what was then one of the Tenderloin districts of L.A., dominated by sex shops, XXX movie theaters, and pizza joints that were fronts for drug dealers. Nominally, the place where Doug worked specialized in nature films and industrials, but off the books, it was doing a ton of porno films. Doug and I had the run of the place, provided that we worked at night, which I was now accustomed to thanks to American Graffiti. Occasionally, we heard the unmistakable sounds of grunts, moans, and bodily friction being mixed in an adjacent room. The Initiation is technically weak, but it was an ambitious undertaking for me at the time, and it gave me a nice running start at USC. Cheryl and I both chose to attend college locally. To save money, she spent her first 2 years at Los Angeles Valley College, a community college, while living at home with her dad. She got her requirements out of the way there and then transferred to Cal State Northridge, where she majored in psychology. Unlike Steve in American Graffiti, I had no desire to see other people while at school. Instead, I became intimately familiar with LA's freeway system while regularly commuting in my bug to Burbank to see Cheryl. And sometimes when I got homesick, my parents and Clint. I moved into a dorm room on the 3rd floor of Trojan Hall at USC and happily assimilated into college life. My freshman roommate grew marijuana under an ultraviolet light in the closet. I was not a pot smoker and always politely declined when it was offered to me, but plenty of people in the American Graffiti cast and crew were, so the sight and smell of weed didn't make me feel uncomfortable. I don't know how this happened, but a rumor took hold that my roommate and I were in business together. A couple of years later, when I was on Happy Days, Marion Ross said to me nonchalantly, "I heard that you were one of the biggest dope dealers at USC." I'm afraid not. That is one dopey-opey scenario that was too good to be true.
If you're looking for the family dopehead, that would be me. I spent the majority of my teenage years learning how to catch a buzz. It all started when I was 14. One of my childhood buddies, a fellow Howard's Hurricane, I'd known since second grade, had hippie-ish older brothers who offered to kick us down some weed. But we would have to wait. They wouldn't be scoring for a couple of weeks. Over the course of those 2 weeks, I was beside myself with nervous anticipation. What's it like to smoke marijuana? I'd witnessed plenty of drinking, Dad always had a six-pack of Schlitz Tallboys in the fridge, and Bob Totten medicated himself with whiskey in the director's chair. But the only place where dope ever crossed my radar was in the movie Easy Rider, which Mom and Dad took us to. I thought Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper were incredibly cool. I wanted in. I was so anxious about my pending marijuana experience that I did what an actor does. I rehearsed. I took some pencil shavings from my pencil sharpener, rolled up a joint, and sparked it. I took a few drags and coughed up a storm. I can report with certainty that there is no such thing as a pencil shavings high. All I got was the harsh taste of fireplace smoke and possibly some lead poisoning. But finally, along came the big day. My buddy had scored a couple of joints, and a few of us gathered in a Toluca Lake alley to partake. I took my first couple of puffs and immediately thought to myself, when does the shit hit you? A couple of minutes later, we were all giggling. This laughter was stifled somewhat when one member of our group was gripped by a brief bout of paranoia. I loved the high, and I tolerated the come down reasonably well. I must have been a little paranoid too, because as soon as I got home, I hopped into the shower and scrubbed myself raw for 20 minutes to ensure that Mom and Dad wouldn't suspect anything. Overall, my maiden voyage smoking weed was a success. I'm someone who likes to laugh, and weed made me laugh even more. It was my boon companion. I was not having success with girls. In the sixth grade, I had a heavy-duty crush on a classmate named Paulette Fraconi. And in the seventh grade, some of my buddies started pairing up with girls our age. One of my friends fell so hard for his first steady that he crudely carved her initials in his hand. I found that nuts, though I understood his passion. I really wanted a girlfriend, but I couldn't work up the nerve to ask someone out. By high school, I managed to score a few dates, but they never developed into relationships. I yearned for what Ron had with Cheryl, but no such luck. So, pot became my girlfriend. That's how I looked at it. It was easier to score pot than booze in high school. Weed was in widespread circulation among Burroughs students, whereas alcohol still required trickery and subterfuge, a fake ID or an older person willing to buy on your behalf. So at the beginning, I was more often stoned than blitzed. But the lure of drinking was too hard to resist for long. When I was little, I became fascinated by the very idea of drinking. It was so ritualized in the 1960s and early 70s. Mom and Dad always had martinis when we went out to a nice restaurant like the Smokehouse. And what did Ron and I drink? Shirley Temples. A Shirley Temple offers everything but the alcohol. Sugar for a high, crushed ice, a swizzle stick, and a tiny parasol. This drink is, I believe, society's way of training kids to participate in cocktail hour, named for a child actor, no less. So I became curious about what it must be like to drink a real cocktail. I resolved to find out. It started with me in my mid-teens going into our parents' liquor cabinet when they weren't around and having a few pops of brandy straight out of the bottle. To a kid, that stuff tastes putrid. Funny how that didn't dampen my curiosity. Pretty soon thereafter, I started having friends come over to drink beers in the rec room out back of our house when Mom and Dad weren't home. Yes, the very same rec room that Mom didn't want Ron and Cheryl canoodling in. We paid an older kid who worked in a liquor store to sneak us six packs of tall boys out the back door. We didn't sip these beers as we played a game or two of pool. No, we liked to shotgun them. That's where you poke a church key in the side of the can, crack open the flip top, and guzzle the beer through the keyhole in one go. Right away, this was my approach to drinking beer. Is that normal? Is that somebody socially enjoying a beverage? I don't think so. My belief is that I came preloaded with alcoholism and drug addiction. I don't think I developed a problem. I was born with the disease like my granddad Butch. All I was waiting for was access and opportunity. We never spoke of Butch's condition as a sickness when Ron and I were kids. Society didn't use that kind of vocabulary back then. But we saw him acting strangely, stubbing out cigarettes on the sides of Mom and Dad's cars, leaving burn holes in the paint. We heard Dad's stories about him downing a pint in the supermarket parking lot, and we knew that Butch's sister, Aunt Julia, with the pinned-up blue hair, ran the family's business affairs in Duncan because her brother was not up to the task. My parents became aware of my new habit when Mom picked me up from a ninth-grade party at a classmate's house where there had been no parental supervision. I had consumed ridiculous amounts of cheap wine and vodka, and it wasn't sitting well. In the car ride home, I puked all over the interior of Mom's yellow Plymouth. Rainbow colors. The next morning, Dad gave me a talking to, though it was more firm than ferocious. He simply laid out the dangers of overindulging in drink. Honestly, I don't remember much of what he said because I was too hungover. Mom spoke to me, too, in measured tones. She never specifically mentioned her father, but something about her vibe, the worry in her voice, the fear in her eyes, suggested to me that she was making the connection. After all, I look like young Butch. Neither Dad's warnings nor getting sick from binge drinking scared me straight, though. Perversely, even as I was still clammy and wobbly from hurling, I couldn't wait to drink again. A person who has an allergic reaction to something he has eaten isn't eager to try that food again. A person who burns his hand on a hot stove isn't eager to touch a burner again. But an alcoholic is different. I thought to myself, wow, I feel terrible. But when can we do this again? This experimentation coincided with a professional downturn, the same shitty wake-up call that Ron experienced after Andy Griffith. At the time that I completed The Red Pony, I regarded that film as a beginning, the kickoff of my next more mature phase as an actor. But it turned out to be an ending, the last hurrah of my juvenile performing career. Soon after, my fortunes changed for the worse. I first felt the slippage when I was cast in an ABC series called The Cowboys, based on a 1972 John Wayne movie of the same name. To outward appearances, it looked like a great job. Bob Totten was directing the pilot and was involved in the casting. It was my first TV series since Gentle Ben, and the show was right in my comfort zone. Given my track record in westerns, it was about seven teenage boys who were pressed into service as ranchers in the New Mexico Territory in the 1870s. I was one of the seven boys acting alongside talented guys like Bobby Carradine and A. Martinez, who were several years my senior. It felt good to be the young gun actor on the set, the veteran who could act with the big boys. But Totten was unceremoniously let go after the first episode. And then, as soon as the script started rolling in, I became demoralized. My character, Steve, I can't believe I even remember his name, had only a couple of lines per show. Nothing plot-related. This would be the case for all 12 episodes of the brief, ignominious life of the Cowboys. I was basically a bit player. Shortly before I landed the series, I had been appointed editor of the David Starr Jordan Middle School yearbook. Journalism was the first elective class that I'd ever taken in school. I fell under the tutelage of a terrific teacher named Steve Campbell, who lit a fire under me and made me realize that I was a good writer. I started winning awards with my pen rather than my face. Being the yearbook editor played to my strengths and was the sort of socially validating post that would have helped me get through the awkward ordeal of early adolescence. But I had to give up the editorship for the Cowboys. And then I found myself in TV purgatory, the seventh banana in a cruddy eight-banana Western that was destined to fail. On top of that, I was losing my little kid looks. My face was physically changing. My brows were getting bigger and darker. Acne descended upon me, pimples everywhere. Clint, the cute towhead, vanished seemingly overnight, his straight blonde hair turning brown and frizzy, into curls. I looked at myself in the mirror and thought, what the hell just happened? Who will ever go out with me? This is not atypical stuff for a kid going through puberty. But it's brutal when you're a child actor and you're known for a certain look. When that look is gone and your hormones are doing a number on your body and your brain, you start to feel the uglies inside and out. And it sure as hell doesn't help that your career stalls or that you like to get loaded. It's important for me to point out that I am not in any way attributing my substance abuse to my struggles in my mid-teens as an actor. I'm simply saying that these two phenomena arrived in my life at the same time and made for a toxic brew. No work plus access to booze and pot equals trouble. But here's the thing. Initially, I thought I could handle it. I was good at keeping up appearances. I still received good grades and had good friends. It was a while before my habits and conduct were problematic enough to cause my family concern.
I was no longer a full-time member of the Howard household when Clint started drinking and getting high, so I wasn't there to bear witness to his overindulgence. Even when I learned that Clint was smoking pot, it didn't bug me. Between USC and American Graffiti, I had become totally acclimated to environments where marijuana was a constant. My generation believed that smoking pot was actually less detrimental to one's health than drinking, and I didn't yet know that Clint was drinking. Beyond all that, I knew that Clint had an active social life, and I was rooting for him to have fun at Jordan Middle School and Burroughs High School. In some ways, I envied him. Growing up, I had always regarded myself as something of an outsider. I thought that I was inordinately square, and Clint was normal. Now I was comfortable being inordinately square. It hadn't held me back from meeting and falling for Cheryl, but I didn't want that for Clint. I admired that he wasn't hampered by social inhibition. It took me a long while to suspect that anything about Clint's life was amiss. Besides, I was consumed by my own drama. In my first semester of college, I remained preoccupied by the thought of getting drafted. Then, the 72 election was decided in favor of President Nixon. Say what you will about Watergate and his many other transgressions, but Nixon kept his promise to end the draft. The last draft call that required young men to report for military duty was on December 7th, 1972. The following July, the United States officially made the switch to having an all-volunteer armed forces. I can't convey the magnitude of relief I felt for me and for my friends, such as Noel. My draft lottery number, 67, wasn't as scarily low as his, but it was low enough to keep me up at night. I was fortunate to escape the fate of the many young American men who were killed, injured, or, like my American Graffiti castmate Paul Lamatt, traumatized by their time serving overseas. I took that folded-up notice out of my pocket and tore it into pieces. At USC, I hedged my bets about the future. I enjoyed taking classes, in particular, one that was devoted to reading classic books, plays, and stories, and then watching and analyzing their film adaptations, The Grapes of Wrath, Summer and Smoke, An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. The last is an Ambrose Bierce story that the French director Robert Enrico turned into an Oscar-winning film short. It inspired me to adapt another Bierce story, A Horseman in the Sky, about a Union soldier who kills a Confederate spy who turns out to be the soldier's own father. Cheryl's dad was a gifted amateur photographer and documentarist who owned an early 16mm Bolex, a Swiss camera that he carried with him when he climbed Mount Fuji in 1947. After a tutorial, he lent me the Bolex, which came with three Zeiss lenses that were perfect for capturing the period look I was going for. We shot the film in Malibu Canyon. Dennis Weaver's son, Robbie, played the Union soldier, and Dad played the Confederate. But after the positive experience of American Graffiti, I decided to keep on acting, lest my trail go cold like it had when I turned down those Bonanza and Mod Squad jobs in the late 60s. It's not like any prime parts were coming my way, though. One of the few decent ones I got was in a forgettable exploitation thriller, theatrically released as Happy Mother's Day, Love, George, and later retitled Run, Stranger, Run. No matter what it was called, those titles alone are red flags, should you wish to hunt down the movie and watch it. The actor, Darren McGavin, directed the movie, which was set in a sleepy New England fishing village. I played a drifter named Johnny, who returns to this town in search of the father he never knew, a different kind of role for me. I barely remember the plot, except that my character got blamed for a series of gory murders that had actually been committed by his teenage cousin, played by Tessa Dahl, the daughter of Patricia Neal and Roald Dahl. For such a tawdry movie, we had a surprisingly strong cast. Darren used his charm and charisma to bring his actor friends on board and will the movie into existence, setting an example that I would emulate a few years later when I began trying to launch my own passion projects. Neal herself was in it alongside Tessa, as was the singer Bobby Darin, and just a year removed from winning an Oscar for her astonishing performance as a lonely Texas housewife in the Last Picture Show, the great Cloris Leachman. Cloris was to play my mother, a diner owner who had long ago given up Johnny for adoption. Before I was awarded the role, I was told by my agent that Cloris wanted to meet with me for a read-through, just to make sure that the chemistry was there. I was given her address and a time to report for the meeting. On the designated day, I left my dorm room and drove to Cloris's house. I arrived at the front door to find a note taped on it. It read, "Meeting will be in the backyard. Come on in." As I entered, I expected to hear voices, Darren McGavin, Cloris, maybe some other people involved in the production. But all I encountered was silence and empty rooms. Finally, through the back door, I caught a glimpse of Cloris, completing some laps in her pool and then pulling herself out of the water. She saw me and waved me over. Cloris was at the time 47 years old. She had an amazingly taut, athletic body. I know this because she was wearing nothing but an extremely skimpy black bikini and was dripping wet and in no hurry to dry off or get dressed. "Ron, hello," she said, flashing that broad, luminous grin for which she was known. "Can I get you an iced tea?" I accepted her offer, but first she told me that she had just wanted to meet with me one-on-one to make sure that we would hit it off. I was starting to feel nervous and uncomfortable. Then Cloris asked me to follow her into the kitchen, sashaying in her bikini bottom, while I stared but tried not to really stare. It occurred to me at this moment that she had won an Academy Award for playing a middle-aged woman who had an affair with a teenager. As Cloris poured us two glasses of iced tea out of a pitcher, I was gripped by fearful anticipation akin to what I used to feel in school when I thought I was about to get into a fight. Was I being put to some kind of test? Was she going to make a move on me? Was I not going to get the part if I demurred? Could I turn up my hands and say, "Sorry, I have a girlfriend"? Should I turn on my heels and simply make a run for it? Cloris handed me my iced tea and held hers. We were standing no more than a foot apart. She flashed me another smile and leaned in ever so slightly, as if she was about to initiate something. I took a big slug of iced tea. She seemed to be enjoying my nervousness. It's quite a script," I said, trying to drum up some banal shop talk. She held her stance and her gaze for just a moment longer. Then she said, "It is. Let's read through some of this." Only then did she slip on a robe and invite me back outside, where we sat down and read a few scenes very professionally. I drove back to USC to catch an afternoon class, wondering what the hell I had just experienced. Later that day, I got a call from Darren saying that Cloris had loved meeting me and that I was in. When we shot the film, there were no further flirtations. In fact, my conversations with Cloris on the set were relaxed, professional, and creatively inspiring. She was a dream colleague and highly intelligent artist. Happy Mother's Day, love, George, also happened to mark my debut as Ron Howard. Even in American Graffiti, I was still billed as Ronnie. At last, I was unveiled to the film-going public as a man. Less than a year later, I again got a job playing the son of a character played by Cloris, this time in a prestigious TV movie called The Migrants, with a teleplay by Lanford Wilson. I wasn't even asked to audition. I'm pretty sure I got the part because Cloris had recommended me for it. American Graffiti was released in August 1973, a year after we wrapped. I expected it to get some good reviews, and it did. The New York Times posited that it was arguably the most important American film since Bonnie and Clyde. Roger Ebert called it not only a great movie, but a brilliant work of historical fiction. But the film became so much more, a word-of-mouth hit with staying power. It played in movie houses for more than 2 years after its initial release. I missed out on the premiere because I was on location for another film, but when I got back home, I drove past theaters where there was a two-hour wait to get into the next showing. Cheryl and I caught the movie at the Avco Theater in Westwood near UCLA and were astonished to come across a multi-generational audience that, as one, clapped along enthusiastically as Bill Haley's Rock Around the Clock played over the title sequence. George Lucas's little $700,000 picture went on to gross more than $100 million, at the time the greatest return on investment in the history of cinema. All of us in the cast benefited from our association with the movie, a phenomenon that I referred to as the graffiti glow. Candy received an Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actress. Rick and Paul were signed up to star in multiple movies by Steven Spielberg and Jonathan Demme, respectively. Harrison landed a role in George Lucas's next movie, an off-the-wall, long-shot sci-fi flick called Star Wars. But some of us benefited less than others. Like me. I just wasn't able to parlay my participation in American Graffiti into film stardom. I did Darren's movie, and Charlie and I had supporting roles in one of Lee Marvin's weaker outings, an uninspired Western called The Spikes Gang. I wasn't devastated, though. This lack of traction only reinforced my ambition to stay the course at USC and become the master of my own creative journey. Unbeknownst to me, however, something was percolating in TV land that was to affect my life profoundly. The American Graffiti juggernaut had come in the wake of some similar phenomena. The success of the retro vocal group Sha Na Na, which had played Woodstock and was selling out major rock venues, and the original Broadway production of Grease, which opened in 1972 and proved so popular that it ran for the rest of the decade. This so-called 50s craze set off a scramble among the broadcast networks to develop 1950s-themed series for television. It was at this point that Gary Marshall politely raised his hand and notified ABC that they had a pretty promising pilot for a 50s show in their vaults already. As a matter of fact, it starred one of the leads in American Graffiti.